Okay, any questions? There's a mic somewhere.
Always come here to the microphone. We won't hear your question if you don't stand up and wait back here and then get in line to ask the question. And I have a quick question for you, Brother Prana, which is there's an interesting discussion that Newell gives us in the prologue about the different qualities and symbols of the moon and its light versus like the sun and its more stark light. Is there anything like that in your tradition?
Well, it's very different, actually, because you have to remember that India is a tropical country, so the sun is seen to be the illuminator, but the moon is soothing. See, because the sun in India, when you start getting by March, when the sun rises on the horizon, it is this malevolent little ball that only gets worse. And by 10 o'clock, if you're out for more than a short time, you can get a heat stroke. So the moon is seen as soothing. So we talk about you would have the sun of illumination and the soothing moon of love. So, also within the Hindu tradition, the emphasis is so much more on remember your real nature. Remember, remember, remember your own divinity. That we don't go much into the shadow. It's like, eh, so what? So what? Sai Prabhavananda, who was the founder of our center, said, when you go to the bathroom, do you examine the contents in the toilet? Like, he said, just flush it. So the whole thing is, remember our divinity. Don't think about your shadow side. Don't think about, we all have something that's there. But remember, first of all, that the more you go towards the east, the more you leave the west behind. The more we go on our spiritual journey, which includes taking every part of us. Not leaving some behind and say, that isn't me. I would never do that. Taking that with you and just taking this whole big, enormous thing and just moving this forward. Always move forward in our spiritual life. We are never a believer in converting anybody to anything. Ramakrishna, the great 19th century saint of our tradition, said, never tell anyone to change their spiritual path. Rather than encourage them where they are. Never tell someone that they're wrong, that the way they're doing things is wrong. He said, because God is infinite, and infinite are the ways to God. So he would say, go forward, go forward. The more we each in our own spiritual paths deepen our own spiritual life, the more truth we will find. The more he would say, there was a talk about a man who was in a forest, and he said, and so he ran into a monk, and the monk said, go forward. So the first thing he finds is kindling wood, and then he enjoys that for a while. And he says, but the monk told me to go forward, so I went further. He said, and then he said, I found a silver mine. Oh, wow. He said, now I will never be poor again. So he found the silver mine, and then he said, but the monk told me go forward. So then he went further, and he found a gold mine. He said, he was rich as Croesus. And then he said, but he told me to go forward. And so he finally reached the place where there are innumerable gems. And that, he said, was the goal, because innumerable gems in God. In the Hindu tradition, the whole universe is seen as a place with innumerable facets of jewels that are shining, and they're all moving together. They're all responding together. This is in one of our most ancient texts of the Vedas. That each part of the universe is a different facet of these different jewels responding to each other as it all moves together in harmony. So every part of ourself is part of this great harmony. We just don't remember it. We're all divine. We just forget it. So how do we reach back to that place? Always try to remember that divinity is within my heart. That divinity is within the heart of everybody. Everything that I see is a manifestation of this divinity, whether it is suffering or death or disease. It's all a manifestation of this perfect harmony. Disease and death and terror come with our human package. It comes with having a body and mind. It's not a problem. Our problem is how we relate to it. If we fear death, what are we actually fearing? The loss of this external thing? It's going to happen. It's going to happen. What would this planet be like if no one had ever died? I can't imagine there were. I just read somewhere that there was. They're trying to extend life to maybe 500 years, and I thought, oh my God, I will completely kill myself. Can you imagine anything more boring? Anything more boring? I just ran into a friend of mine who said that he has a friend who is responsible for stand-up comedy in a place in Boston, and so this black comedian got up there. He said, now they're talking about, 500 years, you're going to live. He said, well, that's fine. He said, but what are you going to do about being married? He said, baby, you go to a bar and see your baby, I'm going to love you forever. He said, when you're 30 and you're going to die at 70, that's cool. But if I'm 500 years having the sex of the same woman, I don't know. We have to reorient ourselves. That death is just this. It's just this. So we have to remember this is just our external coding. Our mind, the deepest part of our mind goes with us. But our deepest, that deepest part of us can never be born, can never die. It's absolutely one with God. So on that high note, come on, don't be afraid of me. Ask me a question.
I would like to ask you a question about the Hindu understanding of nonviolence.
Yeah.
Because, of course, Gandhi was so important. But at some point, Hindu or India itself seems to have gone away. And now we have such terrible things. That's the attack of those young women, or the one woman, and Hindu rape. So it's sort of a social justice question.
Right. That's very interesting because the Hindu tradition knows that we all, because of this idea of dharma and this idea of vritta, all this harmony, that everything has a place. So one of the greatest scriptures of the Hindu tradition is the Bhagavad Gita, which takes place on a battlefield. And Krishna, who is God incarnate, is telling Arjuna to go out and fight and to kill all those people. Arjuna says, I am not going to go out there because they're my own kinsmen. They are my cousins. They are my teachers. They are my uncles. These are the people that I love. I would rather be dead and kill myself and live as a pauper than to go out and kill these people who are my own blood relatives and these teachers that I respect. And Krishna gets up and says, man up. Man up. Stop being a wimp. These people were killed by me already. And that's when you have the greatest teachings of Bhagavad Gita, in the middle of the battlefield. Now, why would God incarnate say that? Because Arjuna, who was the one who came and asked this question of Krishna, was a warrior. That was his dharma. It was his job, a job that he cheerfully engaged in, and he didn't want to do his duty. His duty was to protect his people. The reason that the war even began was because of terrible acts of unrighteousness. The war started when a woman was taken. And when her sari was taken off, or they tried to take it off, but Krishna had miraculously given her endless amounts of cloth so that she would never be disrobed. But they pulled and pulled and pulled and pulled and pulled and pulled for hours and finally gave up because she prayed to Krishna, if my mind has always been pure, if my mind has always followed the dharma, then protect me. And he did. So these people had stolen away the rightful kingdom of these people. They had tried to kill them. They tortured them. They tried to burn them to death. They had done innumerable harm to other people. But going out and seeing his own friends and family on the battlefield, he didn't want to engage in warfare. So Krishna basically, in Sanskrit, calls him a eunuch. Man up. Get out there and fight. By me, these people are already killed. In other words, the law of karma is already in effect. These people were meant to die in the battlefield. Many of these people on his side were going to die in the battle. That was the effect of actions that would take place. Because of their own thoughts and actions, these actions would take place. And basically the whole place would be turned into a bloodbath. But in the big picture, it had to happen. You had to have a mass cleansing in order for the Dharma to start again. And then it would begin again, because again and again he says, these are bodies. He said, the important thing when you engage, so it's often, India has a great fighting force. The reason they do is that the teaching is, you do your duty, but you never do it out of anger or hatred. Never kill, never wound. Krishna said, the self of the body is not killed when the body is killed. He said, the soul is neither dried nor wetted. It is not affected by heat and cold, pleasure and pain, birth or death. So this warfare that went on had to happen. That said, there are 10 primary virtues in the Hindu tradition, and nonviolence is one of them. So how do we put that together? Well, because nonviolence means putting your ego away and always using unselfishness. Now, what happens when you run into a situation where someone tries to treat you as a doormat and will use violence on others? Do we allow, for the sake of nonviolence, do we allow the Holocaust? For the sake of nonviolence, do we allow children in Somalia to be murdered and raped? For the sake of nonviolence, do we allow our homes to be invaded and violence to be carried on? For the sake of nonviolence, do we not protect those who need protecting? No. And that is the whole question. In the Hindu tradition, the great questions always revolve around Ritta, this divine harmony, and Dharma. What is my Dharma? As a nun, I cannot even defend myself. I might do anything I can to protect others, but I cannot use violence. As a soldier, as a warrior, that is your duty. You are here to protect others. When you protect others, never, ever engage in hatred and in anger. You are doing your duty, knowing that you are doing it for the sake of God. You can do your duty as a warrior knowing that I am doing it for a higher purpose. I am not doing it because I'm angry. Do you know who I am? I'm going to kill you. Never. But I'm here on the battlefield and I'm doing my duty. So what happens in India, with these wonderful highest teachings, you still have the reality of human selfishness. A human selfishness which says, look at this pretty girl here. Well, I guess I can just take her, can't I? And the reality of a situation that has had years of judicial and political corruption that knows that there's very little recourse. And how could this have happened in our country 20, 30 years ago if you were a young black woman in the South, in the North? Could this happen today? It happens today in Los Angeles. It happened to prostitutes in Los Angeles with LAPD cops. This is what happens when people in power become drunk with power And this is what happens when people get scared and they figure it's not their problem. Every problem is our problem. If there's a prostitute in L.A. who's being abused, it's our problem too. So we can never think that because something terrible happened, well, you're in the gutter. I guess you've had bad karma, huh? I guess somewhere in your life you didn't think right. You didn't do something right. We've all been there. Every one of us have been in the gutter. Every one of us have been on the throne. Every one of us has been on the battlefield. And every one of us has been raped. One lifetime or another, we've all been through it. The purpose in life is to realize our divinity. To go through all these experiences and realize that the core of everything that pulsates through this universe is that divinity. And to get back through that. And to have the deepest sense of compassion for these people who still have more pain to go through. There but for fortune go all of us. All of us. And we have to remember that oneness.
I asked you earlier on if you would talk about being a non-cradle Hindu.
Yes. I had kind of a funny background. My parents are both from Wisconsin. My mother had been raised a Missouri Synod Lutheran. Very forbidding. So I remember going to my grandparents' house, and we'd be on our knees, and they'd be praying in German. I had no idea what they were talking about, but it was scary. Okay, it was all about sin and damnation, and God, stop, don't hurt me. Don't hurt me. It was basically like this. And I couldn't understand what they were saying, but all I knew is that they were all afraid. My father came from a Baptist background, and he didn't cotton to it at all. So they both got on a train and came all the way out to California to get as far away from that as possible. So we went to San Luis Obispo, where I went to the Episcopalian Church and sort of did that. And I kind of grew up in that. But the whole time, I would say, but Mommy, if God is love, how can we go to hell? And she said, honey, we don't believe that. We believe in reincarnation. It's like, well, then why are you sending me to Sunday school? Because they wanted me to be normal, as if. I found my father's notebook after he died, and he'd been reading these ideas in the 30s. He'd been studying the Bhagavad Gita, the Upanishads, all these ideas in the 30s. And he'd been talking to my mom about it. Now, my mom took a little while because she was more afraid than my dad was. So I went to the Episcopalian Church once when I was here. I cheated on my confirmation test. So, because otherwise I couldn't get my ears pierced to wear nylons. And I went to church once here, and that was it. I said, I'm never going back there again. And my parents said, okay, well, then find something you will go to. So then I went to the Unitarian Church in 1967. And I belonged to LRY, the Liberal Religious Youth Group, which meant lots of drinking, going to, it was good. We had fun. I do not regret one minute of it. And it was a nice, friendly group. We did a lot of political activism, but it just wasn't a lot. It was a great place to hang out, but I didn't see anything particularly spiritual. There was nothing there that would ever fed my soul. But it was fun. I enjoyed it. Then quite accidentally, I was during this time personally trying to stop the war in Vietnam. I was a sophomore at Santa Barbara High, and every morning I'd wake up and think, I haven't tried hard enough. The war is still going on. I haven't tried hard enough. So I belonged to a couple of peace organizations, and one of them on a Sunday morning paired us up, male, female, I think it was Women's Strike for Peace, that to leaflet various churches. So I was paired up with this guy, and we went to Our Lady of Sorrows. And after we leafleted all the people coming out of Lady of Sorrows, because we were trying to promote a peace march down State Street. So after that, we had the stack of leaflets, and it was still plenty of time to get something else. So he said, well, why don't we go to the Vedanta Temple? And I went, what's that? And he said, oh, it's great. It's a beautiful place. It's got a big parking lot. So we went there to go to every car in the parking lot and lift up the windshield wipers and put the leaflets in under that. So after we did all that, it's like, he said, well, let's go in. I said, can you go in there? He said, oh, sure, it's beautiful. So we go in there, and it's packed. There are over 200 people in there. It was really crowded. And there was no place to sit, so I had to sit somewhere up towards the inner shrine. And they had this tall, thin Swami. I mean thin. And he talked like that. And I didn't understand a word he said, because I forgot. God, and the whole time I was thinking, I do not like this, he's too skinny. I said, you know, is this a Gandhi thing? I don't want to be around any people who fast. I'm not into fasting. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. So he was okay, but I liked the feeling in the place. It was very peaceful. So then afterwards, he shook my hand very stiffly. He was sweet, but it was like skinny. So then next to him was this little pumpkin of a Swami, and he just shook my hand, and I just couldn't stop crying. And I was mortified, because I belonged to groups that, you know, we were talking about bombing the Pentagon. You know, we were pretty hardcore. And I was like, you know, stop the killing machine. We got to kill the killing machine. And it's like when I was, that's like, whoa. And he just smiled at me. And I, to this day, I don't quite know why I had that reaction, except I'd never really encountered real holiness, that love, that purity that can actually be transmitted. So I just kept coming back, and I couldn't drive, so I'd have to find someone to take me up there. So I just kept coming back, and lo and behold, in my parents' library, of all things, I found Vedanta for the Western World. I didn't know they had that, so I started reading. And everything, and they'd always raised me with reincarnation, so I kept, the more I read, it was going, check, check, check. Yeah, so then I just kept going up there. And after I'd been going about a month, there was no bookstore at the time. There's just this little table. And the women there said, oh, you keep coming back. And I said, well, how come you're acting so surprised? And she said, well, we thought we were kind of straight for you. And I said, no, I like it here. And she said, well, you'll have to come to our convent. I said, convent? You've got a convent? And I said, where? And she said, well, right down through the parking lot. And I said, well, I'm going to join. She went, ah! Like 10 years later, I showed her. I did. But then, you see, after my, you know, I'm going to be a nun and be spiritual and renounce and meditate, then I discovered boys. And that sort of, you know, took up my life for a while. And then I decided I was really not nun material. So then I went, you know, I finished my college, went to graduate school, taught for a while. And then by God's grace, I got into a really bad car accident. It was a nasty car, and I was living in L.A. And I was in a MG midget that didn't happen to have a neck rest. So I ended up on the side of the road, and they took me to hospital, and for a while I had no feeling from the neck down. I couldn't move my fingers or my toes. I could feel tears here because I was terrified. But the first thing that came to my mind is, now I can't be a nun. And I thought, great, you're a paraplegic, and this is the first thought coming through your mind. Love that. Because I was very busy with my career. You know, I had a career, I had a great relationship with a guy. It's like, hey, this is this. And I realized that the whole thing hadn't been working for me. The whole time I was trying to stay very busy, very engaged, you know, trying to do the whole thing, and I was really not happy with it. That what meant the most to me was this stupid place here in Montecito, up in the hills. And I thought, if I ever get out of this, I'm going to have to explore it. I have to see. And then I found out that that's really what I wanted. And that's how I ended up. I was like, I joined in 77, the year after the accident. And first 3 days, I thought, I've done many stupid things in my life, but this is the stupidest. Because I'd pretty much burned my bridges moving in. And then by day four, it's like, no, this is a fit. This is a fit. So that was 36 years ago. It's been good. It's a good fit.
Whatever time we have left, could you tell us a little bit about how you see reincarnation?
How I view reincarnation?
Yeah, within the Vedanta or personally.
Yes. This all is tied into the idea of karma. Because karma is not, we all hear the word karma, but we don't really realize that it comes from the word krit, which means work or to do. The verb root krit means to do. So karma is not only action, but the effects of action. So every action that I do has a physical effect. If I take my nice book here and I throw it through a window, the effect of that action is physical, first of all. I break a window, there's a physical action, then I get a bill for it, there's another thing. But it also creates an impression on my mind. And that our minds are like Play-Doh. They're very soft and easily molded. So it's like you get a pen or a little knife and you make a little rut in your mind with that action or your thought. So let's say that every time someone cuts me off in traffic, I get angry and I honk at them. And so the first time I do it as an instinctive thing. By the time I've done it 10 times, it's become a habit. Let's say that every time I get frustrated, I take a drink. First time, it's an impulsive thing. By day 10, it's a habit. Let's say that every time I get angry with something or frustrated, I blame them. That becomes a habit. First time, maybe it's a new thought. By the time you've thought it the second, it becomes a deep... By the time you've had that piece of chocolate after supper 5,000 times, you don't know how not to have it without a piece of chocolate. Our minds are that malleable. So these create what is called samskaras in our mind, deep impressions. These impressions have been with us since the very beginning of when we've had minds. So when the body dies, these impressions are in seed form and will pop up when the new environment is propitious to it. Now, I like to sing, and I really like to sing a lot, but I never had the opportunity till I was kind of dragged into a situation where there was choral singing. And all of a sudden, I found that I had this passionate love for choral singing. Now, had that impression not come into my mind, I would have never known it. Now, Mozart wrote his first symphony at, 6, 7? He was born into a family of musicians. Because when he died, he had all this musical desire and ability. So that those deep impressions in his mind and his desire put him karmically in a place where he would be born into a family where that could express itself. Because it's not only our actions and the effects of our actions, it's also our own desires. So if at the end of our life, all of the thoughts we have thought, all of the effects of our actions, and all of the memories of our life will come towards us, flooding toward us like a tsunami. They talk about your whole life goes before you. It does. And all the effects of that will propel us into our next birth, whatever it may be. If your actions and thoughts and desires are such that your whole life, what you've wanted most of all is money, you will have a birth where you can realize that. It can either make you happy or unhappy, because all the good and bad deeds that we have done in our life will pull us toward a situation where we will experience both happiness and grief. Now, just because I am born blind does not mean that that's the effect of bad karma at all. Just because you're born with cerebral palsy or without arms does not mean that's a result of bad karma, because you actually might be quite happy. And really, it's our happiness and unhappiness that means either good or bad karma. How we react to the karma that we are experiencing determines our own future. If I react to the pain in my life with bitterness, anger, jealousy, and viciousness, I will create bad karma. And this will come to me either physically or mentally in one birth or another. Most of the time we stay in human bodies. If our karma is better served in such that we can experience something more in an animal body, it will be so. Maybe you have desire to experience something so much that only a dog body will give it to you. But mostly we're going up this evolutionary ladder So the point of being of reincarnation is not to be born again and again and again on this god-awful nightmare of a merry-go-round where our actions are being driving us and our desires, but to realize our own divine nature so that we can be free and to be absolute one with this divinity that pervades the world. And so that if we come back to earth again, it is in our own free will to serve, to help others, not because of our desires, not because of the effects of our own actions. And I think we are out of time.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. Appreciate it.